Coming from the backwoods of New Jersey, welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host Tom Coyne. And today we're joined by special guest Brent Dorner from Helix and also my wicked twin.
Yeah. Hello, everybody.
How you doing, Brent?
I'm good. I'm just chilling after my wicked twin release.
Nice. Well, we're going to talk about My Wicked Twin in a little bit, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn it over to Tom because he's got a lot of real cool questions about the Helix days that you were in the band. So you go for it, Tom.
Well, obviously, I'm a very longstanding, as you could see, Helix fan. And sure. I wanted to start off from the beginnings of the band, which there were two independent releases, which kind of were before you guys really developed your full sound. If you could tell me a little bit about those early releases, how the band came together and those two albums.
Well, I could try to make it quick. I mean, back in the day, back when the Dead Sea was still sick, we were in the Musicians Union. The Musician Union stated that you had to be in the Musician Union too. If you quit a band, you had to replace yourself with another musician of the same or higher caliber. I knew this guitar player, Ron. He passed away. And he said, I'm going to leave this band called the Helix Field Band, and will you replace me? And I said, yes. So he took me to the Helix rehearsal hall, and I was standing there, and they were playing songs, and these Helix guys were all looking at me going, like, who's this guy standing over here, right? That was me, right, with my guitar. And then Ron finally tells him he's leaving the band, and I'm his replacement. So that's how it worked back then. And that's how I started. We were a cover band playing cover songs. And back then we had to play 3 45-minute sets in the clubs. And that would be Monday through Saturday night. So you'd play six times a week, which really built up your chops and your skills, right? And we eventually quit our day jobs and went on the road, which then, you know, we almost starved. We were playing club after club, you know, 50 weeks a year from coast to coast in Canada. We eventually added a first set of all original songs, and the club owners didn't want us no more. And the agents were fighting our manager. And then we added a second set of all original music, and they wanted to hire us even less. And we just felt, and then we went to just two sets instead of 3 45-minute sets. And then we just said, screw it. You want to hire us now? We'll play for an hour and a half, one show. That's it. Right. Not one of this. See you in 20 minutes for the second set. Yeah. Or, you know, enjoy the steak dinner that they got on the menu. Never mind that no more.
And you went all original at that point, right?
Yeah. You know, and then we made the, I borrowed 10 grand from my parents, and Brian, our singer, borrowed 10 grand from his, and we went into the studio and recorded our first album, which I just found it to be horrible to do. I mean, never seen a recording studio before. All the live, everything has been taken away, and now you got your amp stuffed in a corner with a moving blanket over it, right? Mm. The same with the drummer, my twin brother, on the first couple albums. You know, they were taping taping a wallet to his snare drum, and he just friggin' hated it. But we didn't know, but so, you know, we printed our albums and we sold them in the clubs on our breaks. We managed to sell 10,000 albums.
Wow.
As I said, like, we play basically 50 weeks a year from coast to coast. And every once in a while, we get a gig in Michigan or Detroit or something like that. New York State every once in a while, and just in nightclubs. And second album, same thing. And record companies heard, hey, this band Helix, these frigging guys sold like 20,000 albums, and they're not even signed to anybody.
Yeah. Right?
So they came and saw us in Toronto and didn't like us. There was nobody in the club that night. It was like a Tuesday night, empty, right? You know, everybody in the band was slacking off, and they passed on us.
Yeah.
And our manager used to come out, and he wouldn't tell us he was coming. He'd sit there and sneak in to see if we were actually putting on a show and working it, or if we were bagging off, right? He caught us bagging off a couple of times and gave us proper shit, right? Like, you can't, he said, you know, you... So 2 years later, Capitol Records came back into a different club and saw us rocking out like we should have been. And they signed us. And then they wanted to sign us in Toronto. And then Capitol Records LA said, no, we'll sign them here. So it was a 7-album deal. And that kind of kicked off the whole deal with making albums for Capitol Records rather than independent records. On our first label, H&S Records, which was Helix and Sype. Oh. Our manager, H&S Records, Helix and Sype. So that's kind of how it went. And, you know, we went into better recording studios. We learned how to record better. And, you know, Capitol Records were hiring great engineers at that time, you know. So it was just a matter of, you know, we did a lot of pre-production. I mean, we wouldn't work out the songs in the recording studio at $2 a minute in Toronto. You know, cost you $20 to go have a crap, right?
Now, on the third album, there was a huge jump up in sound. There was some changes in the lineup. What transpired with certain guys leaving, certain guys? That, like, the classic lineup was starting to now come into what everybody knew was the classic lineup in Helix and the classic sound of Helix. What was that? What transpired into that big metamorphosis of sound?
So the question is, the sound would have been money, because Capitol Records had a lot more money than we did, borrowing from our grandparents and stuff, right?
Was Capitol Records kind of dictating to you, hey, we want this particular sound, or is that something you just organically gravitated towards?
No, but they would suggest to us, we want to bring in, like, say, Mike Stone, sound engineer. Mike Stone engineered some of the AC/DC in, I think, the first Queen album.
Yeah, Journey, too. Yeah.
Right.
Did he do Journey?
Mm-hmm.
He passed away, you know, Mike Stone.
Yes.
So, I mean, with that, having high-end engineers, more expensive studios, more money to spend, you know, better equipment, all that stuff, more experience in the studio, that's how we got to the sound change. And, you know, some guys, just the original members, some guys just simply didn't want to do it no more. Their families were more important to them. So and Helix was getting busier and busier. Like, frig, we never got home. And that was a problem. Like, people don't realize. So you're on the road, you're not making much money, but that doesn't mean that your rent stops.
Yeah.
You don't have to pay your rent while you're not there for 6 months. You got to pay your monthly rent and shit, right?
Yeah.
So that's that, you know, and everybody go, man, these guys must be on drugs, or they were skinny. Well, who could afford drugs? We can hardly right. afford food.
Right. You could be skinny just by your diet.
Or lack of diet.
Or lack of diet, right.
Yeah, and we meet people on the breaks, you know, in the clubs, and we'd be selling them albums and stuff, and we'd ask people just what we'd go, hey, like, are we too loud? Does the mix sound okay? Can you hear the singer? How are you guys? Where are you guys from? We all did that every break, every city, every night. And we had a big mail-in fan club deal. And there was at a time that we responded, hand-wrote letters back to everybody.
Wow.
No shit. We did that back then. It was our management's doing. We made a grassroots following for the band. And when the guy's wife would go, hey, you guys want to come over to our house for supper on Saturday? Would be a good go. Yes. Yeah, food, right?
Yeah. A home cooked meal.
Yeah. Now, there were two songs off this album that I remember made even American radio play. Does a Fool Ever Learn and Heavy Metal Love. Were these songs like written in kind of more for the American market that was starting to really blossom with the hard rock hair metal scene?
I don't know if we were targeting a kind of a metal market, but
right.
I don't know if we were, I could say this, we always stayed current. Like we always listen to new music, and I still do today. I listen when I'm in my car. I listen to the college station because you can almost be guaranteed to hear something new every day. So we, like I say, we would stay current to what is actually going on out there. What's popular? What is it that the people are lending their ear towards? And I guess at that time, it wasn't just the music, but I guess image. So it was the hair metal.
Yes, absolutely. And it was at the very, 83 was like the beginning of that, because this Helix album was very similar to what Autograph and Rat, a lot of bands in the States were doing. It was commercial, it was catchy, but it was heavy, a lot of guitars, a lot of image. And I always felt that Helix was one of the first bands, if maybe the first band out of Canada, that jumped onto like that scene that was exploding in the States.
Well, I mean, because, we go and do a tour in the States, just a club tour, just playing our stuff, right? And we played just a shitload of American cities from coast to coast, border to border. And we that's where our grassroots fans came from. We entered the Billboard charts. I noticed that too. It was like, I think the highest we ever got was in the 80s or something, 80 on the Billboard chart, something like that. Because we were touring, we were familiar with all the other bands, Rat, Doc, and everybody who was out mm-hmm. there. We were hearing them, right? We were seeing what they were doing.
It was really the first Canadian, I'm a big Canadian metal aficionado. I would say you guys and maybe Coney Hatch were the first bands that I thought from Canada that kind of like ratcheted into that sound that was exploding in the States.
Well, that's cool. Kim Mitchell's just a great artist in Canada.
Honestly, not a huge fan, but
I know he's big in Canada.
I know he's big in Canada. Not my cup of tea.
It's his flippant songwriting style and lyrics.
Yeah, no, I mean, I appreciate
him. As a songwriter, that's why I like him.
Yeah, no, I get it. He's not my cup of tea, but Helix and Coney Hatch were my cup of tea.
I know those guys.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you talked about all the touring you did in the States. Was there a lot of bands? And I mean, going back on our podcast itself, we had one of our first podcasts, we had the guitar player from Legs Diamond, right?
Yes.
And that was a band that was really popular in like Texas, San Antonio area. Did Helix have like a following or a pocket in any parts of the country in the U.S. that you guys were like really popular?
Actually, San Antonio, because
I bet.
There was a famous DJ, Joe.
Yep.
And he actually started spinning our first independent album. And we got a following going. All the universities were all listening to it on Joe's station. He passed away too. And we actually, because of that airplay, we went to Texas and played these outdoor shows. And our one warm-up band was Alcatraz with Steve Vai.
Wow.
No shit. And I went, whoa.
And that's a phenomenon. That album with Steve Vai is phenomenal.
Show me something on the guitar, right?
Right. And Vi at the time was fresh out of Frank Zappa's band. He had never even played like metal before. Like he was with Zappa for years.
Yeah, and we came home from Texas and they put that in the newspaper here in Kitchener. We were like stars.
Oh, I bet.
Because Helix played in Texas. Like, I don't know, who else has played in Texas in this whole province? Nobody?
Right. Well, that's what I just said. I think really Helix and maybe Coney Hatch were the first bands that really latched into what was exploding in the States, which was the very early infancy of the hair metal scene.
Mm-hmm. I guess so, yeah. You know, I did notice that the Guess Who outsold the Rolling Stones and the Beatles one year.
Really?
They were that big.
Yes.
But, you know, they weren't a heavy metal band.
No.
Totally great songwriting.
Great songs, yeah. Great songs, great singer.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So I want to take you to Walking the Razor's Edge. This was the next album after you guys broke the scene. Could you tell me a little bit about the recording and the process of that album?
Which album did you say?
Walking the Razor's Edge.
You got a reference.
One of your many gold albums that you have on the wall.
I got four golds and two platinums over here.
There you go.
Before we went on the air, I was telling Mark how big Helix was in Canada back in the day.
Can you see that?
Wow.
Oops. Yeah, there they all are.
Yeah.
Nice.
Thanks. All right. So I got to tell you, we would like get off the tour bus, go into the recording studio, record the songs because we always did pre-production. So you didn't waste $2 a minute going over one of your leads or figuring out how you're going to sing this part or play that part at $2 a minute.
Yeah.
We go in there, record it, jump on the tour bus and go to the next gig. That's what I can tell you. Like none of us really learned the art of recording as far as turning any knobs or anything. Capitol Records would have all the engineers in place. You know, we didn't have to learn what knob to turn, what sound to go for as inside the studio. We left it to the studio techs to mic it properly. And sometimes, you know, we experimented with mic placements and stuff and amplifiers and hallways and long distance microphones on the amps and stuff like that. I can tell you that the Virgin Recording Studio in England, that drum room was the same drum room as Phil Collins' In the Air Tonight drums. In the Air Tonight, that was recorded in that same room. And that had a stone floor. It was a round, because it was an old castle. And it had a round turret that went way up, like 25 feet up. That was the drum room. The ceiling was 25 feet up. It was all stone all the way up. They had microphones 25 feet up, halfway down, on the floor, behind the drummer. And they basically mic'd the drum room rather than the drums, you know. And we all know that John Bonham did that at the house that Led Zeppelin rented, where they just set him up in the stair hole there in that old house. Mm. He recorded his drums in the stair hole, I believe. And that's how, but you know, John Bonham spent 2 days on just a kick drum sound.
Mm-hmm.
I read that.
Did you and Paul Hackman kind of tailor your style of guitar playing, especially live after Judas Priest? Was there any similarities or...
First off, we never argued on who was going to play the lead ever. We weren't that way. We ever felt, maybe you have a better feel for this song solo wise than I do. Or I might have said, well, I wrote the song and I'd like to play the solo on it because I feel I've got the best feel for the song, right? But we never argued over anything guitar playing wise, really. I go, Paul, that's a stupid way to play that, okay? Why don't you play it like this?
Because I always thought you guys were like, in a live setting, were like peanut butter and jelly. It always seemed to work really. I thought there was a great, you know, dual guitar. You never got in each other's way or upstaged each other. Or
No, I was, you know, while I was reading tablature, like religiously on the tour bus and learning tab and reading all the hottest stuff in guitar player magazines, Paul was more of a wood chopping guitar player, mm-hmm. more of a blues feel kind of guy. And he was a kind of a sloppy lead player, just like Jimmy Page, for example. Like Jimmy Page live, let's face it, like he's a sloppy guitar player.
Right.
Have you not noticed?
Yeah.
No, I have. I mean, I saw them live in 77 at the Garden, and it's one of my three or four favorite bands. But live, Jimmy Page was sloppy. But I always, and you as a guitar player, you could tell me if I'm right or wrong. I always looked at him that Led Zeppelin had so many guitar tracks in their album, and they played with a really small band. You know, it was just him.
Don't get me wrong.
He had so much to cover. Zeppelin
is like, right. like one of my favorites.
Right. But he had so much to cover.
Stating a fact, the guy live is a sloppy player.
Yeah.
But you don't hear that on the albums, of course.
Right.
Maybe they were... had one too many beers before he went on or something.
Well, I'm sure. No, he did. Oh. He did. He had a lot more than beers.
But, you know, I was just stating a fact. I'm not talking down about Jimmy Page.
No, believe me. I'm.
Yeah.
So I want to take you to my favorite Helix album, Long Way to Heaven, which I know at the time was an album that was a little bit maligned because it was considered to be too commercial. But I like commercial hard rock also. And to me, I thought this was the epitome of the band, regardless of what, you know, people said at the time. What was your take on the album? Did you think it was too commercial? Did you guys write purposely commercial?
I got to tell you, when you're finally done an album, I don't listen to them. I'd have to actually review the songs on one of those labels to give you a straight answer. Like, I don't listen to Helix songs. I don't even listen to my Wicked Twin songs. By the time you're done writing and recording them and releasing it, I basically don't much listen to them again because it's time to move on to the next thing, right? So quite honestly, I hear the songs on the radio from time to time, and it's nice to hear them. I think that sort of answering one of your earlier questions, the sound... The recordings sounded better on the radio than they did on my stereo at home. Does that make sense?
I guess it could, yeah, depending on what your headspace is when you're listening to it, yeah.
Yeah, see, I'm in the car and I hear myself on the radio. It always seems to sound better on the radio.
Well, it's the environment. You're hearing yourself on the radio and you're realizing, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of other people are also hearing that at the same time.
I guess.
Yeah.
Like a song like Deep Cuts the Knife, which is one of my favorite Helix songs, Long Way to Heaven. They were a little more commercial than the previous albums, but I was a fan of that. Did you guys look to be even a little bit more commercial out of the heavy metal, or did it just come from where you were at the time?
I guess just with... like, we were involved heavily with all the bands around us, and we were a warm-up band for friggin' everybody, right?
Well, we spoke about off the air about Rush, all the shows that you did with them.
Yeah, we warmed up a lot of big bands, and so we were in tune with the scene, I guess. And those sounds and those songs and what's going around you kind of influence songwriting, I guess you might say. And we always had that, A Long Way to Heaven was kind of that, I don't know, I would still have to say we've got the same type of song on our very first independent album, like Thoughts That Bleed is very similar to...
Yeah, it is. I could see the similarity.
No, they're not similar sounding or anything, they're similar sounding, but they're not similar in the way they were written. But we had that kind of a feel even on our first album.
Was the band at that time marketed for a bigger audience? Because like when I got turned onto Helix a couple of years before this at the time, and to me, they always, for a Canadian band, they seemed extremely American. Like you guys were right on par with all the big American bands, more so than maybe the other Canadian band. Was that your management or was the direction of the band or a combination of both?
I'd have to say, you know, like we spent if you do the big, if you tour Canada and you hit every big city in from Victoria to Vancouver, all the way from the West Coast to the East Coast, you hit every big city, you can do all of Canada, every big city, in about 2 weeks.
Really?
What about the rest of the year?
Mm. Right.
So we spend a lot of our time in America, you know, after we became more and more popular. So spend the majority of the year in the States, really. And then, you know, we did tours in Europe as a warm-up band for Kiss and a bunch of other Motorhead. And we did all these Christmas metal meetings with a bunch of metal bands and all these different countries in Germany, England, Finland, Sweden. We had a number one album in Sweden, you know, so we could go over there and play a bunch of venues like that, you know.
Who are some of the bands that stick out? Like you mentioned all the touring, you opened for so many bands. Just maybe who are some of the tours or some of the bands you played with?
It's easier to say who we didn't warm up. We didn't warm up Van Halen or AC/DC.
Okay, but everybody Queen. Else. And Queen. Everybody else.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was just so many bands. Like, I could pick them off the wall behind you guys, I think. Some of them. We even warmed up for when we first started and we were just kids. We warmed up for a really early 60s, 70s artist, or 50s, 60s artist, really early artist. His name slipped off of me. Johnny Rivers.
Really?
Used to be an artist called Johnny Rivers. Way back when the Dead Sea was still sick.
Yeah, wow. Johnny Rivers. I remember Johnny Rivers sick. On the Ed Sullivan Show.
Right, and we were his warm, or we were his warm up band in
really
Cambridge, Ontario.
That's incredible! I can't believe that.
And even remember Del Shannon?
Sure. Yeah. Unfortunately, I'm that old. Yes.
Hats off to Larry. Run Around Sue, right. Little Town Flirt. We were his warm up band for a whole for 2 weeks.
Wow!
So we. Six nights in one city and six nights in another city.
That's incredible.
Del Shannon. And holy man, that guy was something else. I never seen anybody drink as much as that guy. Really? He killed himself, eh?
Yes, he did. Wow. Yeah.
It was weird. We had to go pick him up at the Toronto airport and bring him to Kitchener for our six nighter there in Kitchener. It was every night sold out, you know, because he had a whole bunch of
strength. Oh, he was really big, yeah. In the early, absolutely.
So, you know, I'm drinking beer with him after the show and hanging out with him. And he tells me that he was riding around on his dirt bike in the desert in California where he lived. And he saw this guy sitting on the mound of the hill, just sitting there. And he said, you know, I was cruising all over the place. And when you're there, I come back and the guy was still sitting there. He said, I drove my bike over there and I realized that the guy had shot himself and fell forward on his shotgun. And the guy was laying there dead, sitting up, leaning against his shotgun. Jeez. Al Shannon told me that story.
Right. Wow.
So, and then Del killed himself in the desert too, I believe.
Wow.
Oh, I didn't know that. I know he committed suicide. I didn't know the specifics of it.
Isn't it weird that he told me that he saw that when I
That is that? Crazy.
And I'm telling you, he said, come and get me tomorrow morning and we'll go have breakfast. Well, you know, when we were back then, we get up at 11 a.m. to go have breakfast. And so I come and get him. I'm in his room. He says he's got his bathrobe on. Let me get dressed and I'll come with you. Just give me. So he pours a hotel glass with 3/4 full of rum. He puts about that much coke in it. Room temperature. Right. This is before breakfast. He just finished brushing his teeth.
Right.
Wow.
So then we have to cut through this lounge to get to where they serve breakfast. He orders 4 double tequilas and he drinks all of them. And then we went and got our eggs. He just boom, 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 boom.
Wow.
Who would have thought? I asked you who you opened for, and we get a Del Shannon story
Del Shannon
like that.
And Johnny Rivers. I still can't get pissed Johnny Rivers. No, that's crazy.
And that Johnny Rivers gig, it was a gig at a theater in Cambridge, Ontario. And the promoter took all the receipts and fucked off, and nobody ever saw the guy again.
Really?
It was his mortgage and everything. He defaulted on his mortgage, took the concert money. Johnny Rivers never got paid. We never got paid. Wow. Thank you. Good night. Next.
Mm. Wow.
So bunch of crazy stories, you know. We're in Edmonton playing. This was back when Gretzky was still on the ice. And we're getting ready for the show. We got the TV on in our hotel rooms, and everybody's putting their stage clothes on. And we're watching the news come on, and they're saying, today here in Edmonton, police arrest the suspected murderer, John So-and-so. And here I am putting him in the car, right? You got the guy handcuffed. You're putting him in a car. He's wearing a friggin' Helix t-shirt.
I don't know if that's like a, you know, good promotion or what.
I don't know if this is a good promotion either.
We saw it on TV with our own eyes.
That is great. There's also been a lot of mentions of Helix in Trailer Park Boys too. I don't know if you're familiar with that show in Canada.
Sure. I just posted one of their memes on my Facebook page, I think this morning or yesterday. It says, Ricky, you know, you can get drunk and smoke all the dope you want and listen to all the Helix.
That's the episode that I saw. Exactly.
Wasn't Sebastian Bach on that?
Yes. The episode with Helix, Sebastian Bach was great. With the
Ricky's Bach. Going, Helix, that's the best fucking concert I ever fucking seen. That's fucking the other ROF, fucking UC, fucking KNL, that's a fucking concert.
That's man. Exactly I so right. Much,
I sold so much dope at that fucking concert, it was great.
That's great. All right, let me bring it to Wild in the Streets. This was your last album before you took a hiatus from Helix.
Wild in the Streets, that was great.
Yeah.
Great album. We shot a great video. We filmed that in the Massey Ferguson plant in Toronto where they build tractors there. So that was filmed inside that tractor plant. If you've seen the video, I think the start of it, I go through a sheet of glass.
Yes, exactly.
At the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we tried to get the sugar glass from Los Angeles, and they can't ship it that far because it's too breakable.
Mm.
So they got tempered glass, two sheets of 4x8 tempered glass, and they put these bullet hit simulators. It's what the special effects guys call them. Drives a hard pin into the edge of the glass, shatters the glass. So a small explosive, you guys just hit the trigger and the glass explodes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we just timed it. But I went through the tempered glass, sheet of glass. And they said, don't wipe off the glass off your arms. You got to hose you down with water to get the glass out of you. It's real glass, right?
Yeah.
So I was a lot heavier when it landed on the back of my head. It pushed me down more than I thought. And the glass ate my guitar to pieces.
Wow.
You know, it was 10,000 little squares of tempered glass, right? So we did that twice for the opening of the shoot. I loved how the video ended. Somehow they put smoke in his microphone and Homer blows the microphone and smoke comes out the end like he's blowing out a candle.
Yeah,
that was a fun time. You know, our manager made sure that everybody wasn't drunk or high all the time on something. And, you know, I could thank him to this day because, you know, none of us ever got addicted to alcohol or any sort of a drug. None of us. You know, nobody turned into an alcoholic and nobody turned into a drug addict. And that was probably thanks to our management. And the other part would be we still weren't really making very much money. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So, well, you got to decide, do you want groceries or do you want drugs?
Right? Yeah.
Now, what held that back? Because by this album, I know, I mean, I can only speak from somebody that grew up in Brooklyn at the time. This album definitely broke the U.S. market. I remember there was, you know, Helix had become like a pretty well-known band in the States. What was the reason that you guys were not seeing the money that you should have been seeing for the success of the band?
Two words, recoupable money.
I was just going to say that. You had to pay back the record company and everything for the recording and all that stuff, right?
They give us $50,000 for to record.
Yeah.
And when they decided, say, well, in the streets, they billed us $50,000 for that video. So there's $100,000 that they're going to recoup first. So say that they shoot two or three, 50 or 100. Some of the videos were $50,000, some were $100,000.
Hmm.
Back then when nobody had a frigging camera, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, after you take, say, the band, we shoot three videos for that one album. Now you gotta go double platinum in Canada just to break even. Now, you know, the gold and platinum awards are the standards are set by the population of the country.
Right.
How they do that, if you didn't know.
Yep.
So in Canada, gold was 50,000, and gold in America is a half a million, which is
right.
10 times more just as the population, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So the same with the platinum. Platinum in the States is a million, and or was a million. I'm not sure if it still is. And platinum was in Canada 100,000. But now that because people don't buy as many records, they've dropped the award status to 35,000 for gold and 50,000 for platinum now in Canada. I don't know what the numbers are in other countries.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. It's something you kind of stop following after the heyday of the 80s, right? Right. It's like when no one started selling albums anymore. You didn't even look at that.
Yeah, like my present record company, Indie Tunes, he was suggesting that we get a hold of Universal Records, which bought Capitol Records and Liberty and everybody, and ask them for a, I forget the word he used, it's like a recount of the Helix sales,
mm-hmm.
because the numbers are through the roof on Spotify.
Okay.
And we think, like, One of those gold albums should have went platinum like a decade ago, because it was almost platinum when we left Capitol Records, right? So it should have been platinum a decade ago. So you call it a when they recount mm-hmm. your record sales, right? Yeah. I forget, they got a friggin' word for it, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So that would be interesting. I don't know if you could ever do it. You know, dealing with a record company is friggin' near impossible.
Yeah.
You know, we sent them 19 or 22 songs, Capitol Records, for the next album mm-hmm. that we had written and recorded. And they turned them all down, all 22 of them.
Wow.
So, you know, they did that to the Stones like last year or 2 years ago, the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, the new one they put out.
Wrote a whole album, gave it to whoever the Stones are with. They turned down the whole album. Didn't like any of the songs.
Really? Wow.
Same with Helix. It happened to us. So,
did Helix ever use any outside writers at all, or was it always just within the band?
Oh, no. We used outside writers for sure. Rock You was written by Rob Halford and Brian Vollmer.
Okay.
And there's a couple of them that was split between Paul Hackman and an outside writer. A couple of them, yeah.
Okay.
And then we had cover songs too. Gimme Good Lovin', Make Me Do Anything You Want, or cover songs, right?
Yeah.
So we just did them. Everybody just assumed if you pick the right song, people don't remember.
Right.
The old version of what were they called? Green Elephant, Gimme Good Lovin'. I forget the name of the band. Oh, something else. Well, people just thought that we wrote the song, right?
Oh, Great White made a career out of that, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and I saw just a few years ago, they were playing Live and Let Die. We were in the car. Live and Let Die. So I went, all right, Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
He goes, no, that's Guns N' Roses. I go, no, that's Paul McCartney.
Right.
He goes, Guns N' Roses. I said, yeah, but Paul McCartney wrote it. Right. That's not only that, Paul McCartney's version's better.
Of course, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So Back for Another Taste was a period that you left the band. What transpired that you left?
Had to have money, buddy. I needed money. I was driven by that. I looked around me. I saw all my friends had houses, cars, wives, and kids. And I had a bicycle, and I was living in an apartment, right? And I said to myself, I went, Brent. And I went, yeah. And I knew it was me because I recognized the voice. And I should have to. I gotta go get a job that pays better than this.
Mm.
So I went right from Helix to house framing. So at 31 years old, I was framing houses.
Wow!
And I did that for about 7 years straight. And I learned a lot about safety. I learned everything there is to know about using a framing square.
And you probably made more money in those 7 years than you did all the years prior in Helix.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. I couldn't believe the freedom I had. you know, at 5 o'clock, you could go home and you had the whole rest of the day to yourself, 5 days a week. Yeah. I couldn't believe it. Like I could do whatever I wanted.
Yeah.
You can't do that when you're on the road, you know?
Right.
And, you know, I immediately doubled my paycheck immediately. So I had twice as much money and twice as much free time. And I just loved it. So that's what it was. I had to have money. I left on good terms. They were all still my friend. They were my friends when I left. And they're still all my good friends now. I talk to them all the time. And I've left the band two or three times now. They asked me to come back and fill in for myself. And I did it a couple times. And, you know, every time I'd leave and Palmer say, come back for a year, I say, sure, right? And so I did that a few times. I always leave on good terms. And we're still friends. I mean, I do some of Palmer's videos for him and stuff like that. Shoot them on green screen, stuff like that, Helix videos.
So you briefly came back for it's a pleasure doing business or a business doing pleasure for you.
Well, I recorded on some of that album, and that I left kind of in the middle of the album.
That was like initially supposed to be a Volmer solo album?
Back for Another Taste?
No, a pleasure doing business for you. That's what I had read. I don't know that for a fact. That's what I had read online. That it originally started as a Volmer solo record, and then it kind of morphed into you came back and...
See, there was a business doing pleasure, and Volmer's solo album is it's a pleasure doing business.
Okay.
He flipped the two around.
Okay.
There's a business doing pleasure that was a Helix album. I'm not even sure if I'm even on that or not. I don't really keep track of it.
Yeah, honestly. You were on it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And then Volmer came to me, and he had re-recorded a bunch of stuff, and he put together It's a Pleasure Doing Business instead, and that is his solo album.
Okay. That's what it is then.
That's why the two titles are kind of flipped around.
Right, right, okay. And that was basically your swan song in terms of appearing on Helix albums, per se.
I don't know. I never really knew if it was, if there was ever really a finale to Helix with me or them, like, there was nothing that was ever a real problem that, you know, it was like, we'll never work together again. You're done. You know, it's over with. We never had any of that going on. We left on good terms, and, you know, Volmer still asked me to go and play a song with him here or there, right? So it's not like, I don't know. Seems like I guess I realized over all these years, I friggin' hate traveling. You can never do what you want. Especially on a tour bus.
Yeah.
You can't do what you want.
No, you're basically a prisoner to whatever you signed up for at
so
that time.
So I finally realized about a decade after leaving Helix that's why I was miserable sometimes, because you just had to stay in line because it was a machine, right? It's not like you can go, I'm going to take this week off and go work on my antique car, right?
Yeah.
Well, you can't take this week off and go home and work on your car. You're on tour. So when do you get off tour? Never.
Right.
I had to sell my 36 Chev I had because I never, ever got off the road. I was just paying to store it.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit. We were talking about this before we went on the air about opening for Rush and what that was like.
Opening for Rush was pretty cool. They had a themed... dressing room each day that their management would make it cushy for the band. One day it might be a beach theme. The next day it might be a forest theme. Or who knows, they'd bring in plastic palm trees and bring in a little kiddie swimming pool and a safe surfboard and stuff like that. A couple of floaty sharks, you know, on that day in the dressing room and that's what they did. You know, I saw Neil Peart talking with his linguist at the dinner table there, but they only spoke in French, so I don't have a clue what they said.
Okay, wow.
They were just speaking with French. Because I think he was teaching them France French instead of Canadian French.
Okay.
So I don't know what the difference is. I never learned it. So
I'm going to turn over more recent things to Mark now and what you've been up to bring all the fans up to speed.
Well, I mean, we say more recent, but let's talk about My Wicked Twin. This is something that started, what, probably 15 years or so ago?
I guess. You know, a couple of the albums, same thing. Like I said before, we never really learned recording. So I had to start from scratch, not knowing anything on how to record. Even though you've been in the studio, you don't learn the recording with Capitol Records. You're in and out.
Yeah.
So then this time I had to record the first couple albums. I wasn't really proud of the recordings, but I was proud of the songwriting. You know, we were first called Brent Derner's Decibel, and then we changed it to My Wicked Twin, and just moved along with a bunch of albums. And I always just strive to somehow find a unique thread of originality, if there is anything left that you can find, that there is to find.
There ain't much.
to find unique song titles, perhaps unique guitar licks or cool drum feels. So anything that you can find that's left to find, and be somewhat of a rock, guitar rock band. I guess that's what I've been doing. So, the most recent album, I'm Nobody Approved. I was been fooling around with AI and made a bunch of AI videos there on My Wicked Twin's YouTube channel. You can go check them out there.
Watching them. Actually, I was going to talk to you about that. So you do all the videos yourself, huh?
Yeah. What I learned AI the hard way. You know, I learned that you can't type in a prompt and tell it to run and make a video for you for 3.5 minutes, the length of your song, because it doesn't work that way. So I wasted a whole bunch of time and money on the first render of, say, three minutes on. So then I tried, well, that didn't work. So then I tried, because it turns into, like, it'll start out with your prompt, but it ends up with Aztec temples and spaceships and friggin' clowns and stuff, right? So then I tried to cut it to for a render to 1 minute, and that didn't work. Same thing. Then I cut it to 30 seconds, and then I ended down at 10 seconds. And then I found that if you, with the prompt, with the AI I was using, you prompt to create a video from text, that I'm going to go for no more than 7 to 10 seconds at a time. So grab a sentence at a time with your images and just render those out. So then you get a whole folder full of videos that match your song.
Right.
Throw that, all those 7 second pieces into your editor and edit them together to match your what you're trying to say in your song, right? To match the song.
Wow. So you're now 5 albums into the My Wicked Twin?
Yeah.
And that's with your brother, Brian, right?
Yeah. Brian brought his electronic drums to my place, at my last house, and he was drumming on them so hard, he broke his drumsticks.
Yeah.
he was beating the shit out of those rubber cymbals, right?
Well, Tom and I were just talking before we went on the air and got connected with you. He was saying, and we were saying how your brother played with Saga for about 6 or 7 years or so. And I just saw Saga like a week and a half ago here in New Jersey.
Is that right? Well, Brian sure spruced up their live show. That's for sure.
He did.
Oh, he's my twin brother's a cut above when it comes to drumming. Not just because he's my twin brother. You can just see and hear it when he drums that he's a cut above. He's just one of those natural guys, right?
Mm. I wanted to ask you, and I was telling Tom this on your third album, which was entitled Three Engines. That was for My Wicked Twin. There was a guitar solo by Paul Chapman. Was that the Paul Chapman?
The country player, Paul Chapman?
Is that, I don't know. I saw that. I noticed Paul the name Paul Chapman, and I said,
we were thinking Paul Chapman from UFO.
Oh, no, this is Paul Chapman, country guitarist.
Okay.
Extraordinaire.
Okay.
Yo, man, can that guy smoke it on the country guitar, right?
Oh, really? Okay.
When I had left Helix and I was doing construction, I was also ended up in a country band, and we used to play cover songs.
Okay.
But I had to learn the solos. And I found it so hard. I'm thinking, how are these country guys playing these solos? So I went into Tab World and read the tab to see how they were doing it. And I eventually learned how to play some of these country guitar solos. And that pretty much changed the way I played guitar from that point on, because I could never go back to just using a guitar pick. Then I ended up getting the other two fingernails growing a little long. And even though I'm playing rock, I ended up with the three finger deal going on from that point on. I could never shake it loose after that. Yeah.
Wow. So what's on the horizon for My Wicked Twin? You said there was just the new album is just out.
Yeah. You know, my record company, they want me to put together another video so you could do another release. And, you know, I took a week off about 3 weeks ago and I'm still off and I like it. I get to it. I mean, I don't think I took time off in like a decade.
Okay.
I'm not really sure. I was always busy. If I wasn't busy songwriting and recording, I was working for, like, I made it like about 152 videos for different bands and stuff. I was filming and editing when I wasn't going to work.
Oh, wow.
For other bands when I wasn't songwriting. And so I was always like extremely busy. So I'm here into this new house. I was here for 2 days. You know, we started tearing the roof off the whole house, a 30-foot big hole, and started adding addition on the place. So 7 months later, here I am. I can sit down. I finally moved in. I unpacked the last few boxes from the last house. last week, I unpacked.
Yeah.
Right? So I liked the time off, and I'm going to go back to it again. I've got a huge folder of song ideas in my computer, which I record on one of these little Zoom recorders, these things, and I'll just these.
Oh, yeah, little digital recorders, SD cards.
Yeah. So a lot of times I'll just get ideas for songs where I don't need a guitar to play. And some of the times when I was striving for ideas, we'd put the guitar down and sing the idea, hum it to yourself. How do you want it to go? Let's get this song written. So then I always like to find a really great song title first, right? And then sing the write the chorus of the song first. So I would sing the chorus, whatever the words, like I just finished "I'd Hide a Body for You, Baby."
I love the guitar sound on that is great.
Thanks, man. So I mean, just that title kind of dictates that it should probably be an aggressive song, right?
Right. That's the evil version of "I Would Do Anything for Love, But I Won't Do That." Is that?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Thanks. Thanks. I played with Meatloaf too. He was great.
There you go. All right. Good time.
You know, COVID killed him, eh?
Oh yeah.
That's how he died.
Yeah. No, I remember Howard Stern talking about that. Yeah.
He did have a lot of health issues beyond that too, right?
Yeah. COVID. I remember hearing that.
We played with him in Denver at the Rainbow Theater, and they were doing "Paradise by the Dashboard Lights," and right at the end of the show, and the climax of that song, the end of the song, he took a bottle of wine and sucked back the whole fucking thing.
Really?
Without stopping.
That's impressive. Even I've never done that.
Wow.
Yeah. No, I couldn't do that. I'd throw up.
And it wasn't even David Lee Roth doing the iced tea in the Jack Daniels bottle, right?
Right.
And he was great. And I, you know, we're backstage. I go, hey, Paul says to him, Paul says to me, so what should we call him, Mr. Meat or Mr. Loaf?
I think the preference was meat, right?
Meat, just meat. No, meat, yeah.
Just meat.
Yeah.
And then, so we're after the show. You know, I noticed that Meatloaf had a black eye right here. And I said, so, hey, you know, you're a pretty big guy. How'd you get the black eye? He says, I went down like this. I was singing and I went down. And our guitar player lifted his guitar back up like that. I got the end of the guitar right under my eye, which was lucky that he didn't get it in the eye.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. His guitar player gave him a black eye. You know, I think Vollmer gave me a black eye with his microphone one time.
Really?
Yeah, you know, him and I crashed into each other a bunch of times. There's Vollmer upstate. There we're in Winnipeg, and he's banging away in a cowbell with a drumstick. And you know, the drumstick breaks off to a real long, sharp point, and he bang, bang away, breaks. He leaves the stick in his hand, grabs the microphone to sing, and stabs himself in the face with the drumstick. Wow. Oh, shit.
Damn.
All kinds of stuff like that. And then he'd come over and wipe it all over me during the show, and then people thought I was part of the show, that he was bleeding, right? And I did that at Maple Leaf Gardens, too, in the opening song, swung my guitar around, split my ear open here. An ear bleed, ear bleeding. I don't want to talk of any politics here. So I'm bleeding all over my guitar, down my neck. We're in the first song. Vollmer comes over to me because he wiped blood all over me one other time with the drumstick. Mm-hmm. New Year's Eve, he comes over and goes, "What happened here? You're bleeding all over the place." I grab him, go, "Yeah!" Wipe blood all over him. People think it's part of the show. It was an accident, but... You know, he did stuff like that.
Yeah. Did you ever open for Alice Cooper?
No. I'm not sure if Vollmer, like, Helix warmed up for a lot of bands after I left, too, right?
Oh, okay.
They might have played with Alice Cooper.
Okay. I was just thinking about the whole blood thing, you know, it would have fit the show.
They were with Ian Gillan over in a couple of countries I hadn't played over there, like.
Oh, they opened for Ian Gillan?
Gillan and a couple other bands over there. You know, I think they opened for UFO. Like that Sweden Rocks Festival is just great, eh?
Right.
Oh, yeah. It's a great show.
Do you know that, remember Gary Moore, guitar player Gary Moore?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Do you know, like we did the Sweden Rock thing on the ferry. The ferry go overnight from Sweden to Finland. And that's when the concert took place, right on the ferry in the concert hall in the ferry. And a really cool theater with balconies and everything. Really great staging, sound, lighting, everything great.
Wow.
And Gary Moore's guitar tech fell overboard into the Black Sea. And they never found his body.
Really? Wow.
Really.
I never heard that. I'm a huge Gary Moore fan. I've read all his
books. Yeah, so was I. I had his albums.
Yeah, Gary Moore was probably the best guitar player of that era that nobody ever knew.
And he's got the speed, and yeah, see, he does barely uses his baby finger. He comes up with all these licks.
That's what I always said about him. Yeah. Right, he was the only guy that played that technical without using his pinky.
Yeah, I don't know where he got the speed from without the fourth finger.
Yeah,
but it was a shame when he passed.
Yeah, he was a generational player. Probably the best player of that 80s generation. And then he got tired of the whole thing and went to the blues.
Yeah, and then, you know, and I still got the Blues for You performance, that live performance he did in England.
Great.
Oh. You know, you'd seen him play the same song in a bunch of different theaters at a bunch of different times. But the one show captured the essence of everything there is to be in a guitar player, singer, and a live performance, like the one show outdid all the others of the same song. You know what I mean? If I've seen, and I still got the blues for you. So, and I love the chord changes and how the bass guitar doesn't follow the guitar.
Right.
That's how you get those weird sounds that you get the sounds that you can't quite put your, where's this note actually going, right? The bass player went that way and the guitar player went that way in that song. And that's how you get those really great chords. That piano players they can easily do that. Mm. And I've been learning about piano through MIDI, right? With My Wicked Twin stuff, where I've been, because I don't really play piano, I would just ghost track a guitar part and record a ghost track, and then I would go over to MIDI and look at my ghost track and just copy myself. You know what I mean? From guitar to MIDI.
Right.
And that's how I got my some of my piano parts and my keyboard parts for My Wicked Twin. And sometimes I have guest players too. You know, I had Kelly Kerlick, guitar player extraordinaire, play the solo on A Body for You. I had a couple of piano players come in. I always have somebody come in and play with on the records with me. And a lot of the times I would prefer to be the songwriter more so than the guitarist. Rather try to be creative that way. Like I play my rhythm parts and everything, but maybe ask some of your friends to come in. you know, and it involves other people, you know, and it's a fun time too, you know.
Yeah. So where can people check out My Wicked Twin? You have a website, social media set up?
You can go to andytunes.com, andytunesrecords.com, and My Wicked Twin's there, and all the catalogs there. Click on My Wicked Twin. That's where it's at, man.
Great.
You know, it's on Spotify and stuff too.
Okay, great.
Because I'm old school, I don't even, I never go on Spotify. I don't own a smartphone. I never have. And I have to go and find my PC if I want to talk to somebody to see if somebody's communicated with, whether it be email or Facebook, right?
Well, Tom and I, you talk about old school and not, you know, Spotify and none of that streaming stuff. I mean, we are two old school collectors, thousands and thousands of CDs, and that's, we like the physical product, you know?
Well, after the second move, I think I sold all my albums because I was just getting carried and moving them around.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in my fifth house now, so I'm glad I didn't try to drag all those albums with me all this time. And I wouldn't have had time for it anyway.
Yeah.
So, but hey, you guys, I appreciate you having me here on this broadcast.
It was great.
I got shitloads of stories, man, I tell you.
Oh, yeah. No, we enjoyed them. Even before we started on the show, we got some good ones. But no, we definitely appreciate your time, Brent. Appreciate everything, the stories about Helix, the My Wicked Twin stuff. So we'll, and when we run the episode, we're going to post the socials and everything. So we'll write the indie tunes and everything and give people that link there.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Brent.
You got it. Thank you, Brent.
Great seeing you.
See you guys. Good night.
All right. Good night. Take care.